Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamal Murray, and we are here with a leader on tour, a very vocal player with a high tennis IQ and just a high IQ for life and how to grow the sport, a favorite in the locker room, and a Canadian superstar who, you know, honestly was leading the charge years ago when Canada was starting to bubble up. You kept hearing Vasek and Milos and then Dennis, right? And then, and you know, Andreescu, but you know, you were at the start of that. So Vasek Pospisil, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks for having me. If half those things are true, then you know, pretty good spot. But I appreciate it.
Well, you know, being a coach, you know, we sit there on our phone for a long time while y'all get massages and y'all are in the locker room just talking shit. So we hear a lot of incidental conversations. So everything that I said is true. You are a favorite in the locker room and well-respected. You know, it's like sitting on my phone on WhatsApp one day and hear people, oh, man, I love that dude, Vasek. He's so damn smart. You know, that's what the players say about you.
Well, that's good. It's good to know.
So you definitely got a career in management and in tennis management after this, right? Because you, everyone wants a piece of your brain. So let me ask you this. Your story is so interesting to me because of just how you merely, you know, came to Canada. So I spent a lot of time in Canada, in Toronto, training, et cetera. And what amazed me about Toronto is how everybody there is not from there.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, it's like amazing that I think of 10 people, maybe you meet one that's actually from Canada, right? And didn't migrate there. So tell me about how you landed there. Tell me about, you know, the roots from the Czech Republic.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Canada's a country of immigrants, some, you know, more recent and some, you know, a couple of generations. But I was actually born in Canada. So I came to Canada as anyone that was born there would, you know, through my mom's womb. But my parents actually, yeah, my parents escaped the communist regime in Czech Republic back in 88 with my two older brothers. They spent a year in Austria working under the table. I mean, just trying to like survive, I guess, or just, you know, save up enough money to come to Canada. And because my uncle escaped a couple of years prior, and he was already in a small town in Vernon, which is where I ended up growing up and where I was born. And so my parents finally, you know, they saved up enough to come to Canada. And then I was born a year later. And then there's a whole, you know, the whole tennis journey began pretty quickly. I mean, ever since I can remember, right? As soon as I started walking, I pretty much had a tennis racket, and my dad was a huge, you know, I guess extremely passionate about the sport. He, you know, was a more of a recreational player, I guess, when, you know, in Czech Republic just played for fun. And but when he came to Canada, he just became incredibly passionate about it, and was, you know, watching tennis on TV, reading magazines on how to coach, reading about, just became, you know, a tennis nut, and started coaching my brothers and wanted one of his kids to be a professional player. So I guess that's kind of just, you know, how it started. And here I am, I guess 27 years later from when I first started playing.
Now talk about, you know, escaping Czech, because I've heard stories of like your dad just being a straight up G, just driving through the border. Like, you know, just driving through border protection and control. Like, not just like, oh, he escaped. He just gangstered his way through the border.
Yeah, I mean, I wish my dad was here to tell you the story, because it's pretty incredible. I've only ever heard it from his mouth a couple times, which is really surprising when you think about it. But yeah, he basically, I mean, they didn't tell their family or anything. They couldn't, right? So they had to be extremely secretive about that. And I just packed up the car with my two brothers in the back seat, my mom in the front, and just went to the border. And I mean, the way he kind of explained it was, you know what, he didn't really even have a plan. He just kind of rolled up to the border. He was in one of the lanes for, you know, I guess the average people who are trying to cross. And then there was like a special lane for special passports, which had a gap in it, and he just said, okay, I'm just gonna go right through it. So he basically just went to that lane, and he put up the passports, and covered the logo, because I guess they had like a special sticker or logo or something on the front of the passport, and didn't make eye contact with the Border Patrol agent. So he just put up the passports, kept looking forward, and the guy was yelling at him to stop, and he just kind of drove through. And at that point, you know, they have machine gun towers and all that, and back then they would shoot cars, right? That would do that. And I guess just, you know, I guess they didn't know who my dad was. I mean, I guess they don't want to shoot someone that, you know, potentially could be a super important ambassador or something. You never know, right? I mean, he has passports. So I guess they just kind of let him through, and he was looking in the rearview mirror, and they didn't come after him. And that was kind of it. But there's a lot more to this story. I mean, this is that, you know, there's that's for like a 2 hour conversation with my dad. Give you the 30-second overview summary.
Yeah. So you talk about, you know, his role in your tennis, right? Your dad had this dream, amateur tennis player, nothing special, but like, I put him in the category of the Richard Williams, you know what I mean? The other parents who just sort of read books, watched videos, and figured it out. And, you know, when I was a kid, one of the things I used to dread was the hour drive home after a bad practice or after a bad match, right? And so it was like, so I know your dad's famous for like long drives, right? Driving. So tell me about the time in the car.
Yeah.
Post practice, post tournament with your father.
Yeah, he was definitely, he was pretty fiery, pretty intense. I mean, you know, he toned down a lot kind of as he got older, but he's the most amazing person, like biggest heart ever. We had, for sure, it's not easy when your dad is your coach. And obviously my dad is super passionate. And like you said, there are, you know, parallels for sure to the Richard Williams story. I mean, I actually saw King Richard, a couple of weeks ago. I was really late to the party, but what an unbelievable movie. And story. But yeah, I was just thinking back to like my dad doing double shifts and you know, working overnights, and whenever he was home, we'd be on the court, and then and playing on, you know, these cracked high school public courts, obviously in a much safer environment. it was a lot of hard work and a lot of passion went to it, right? For the same reason. So just kind of a lot of energy, and then if you're not playing well, I mean, you know, right? So I think my dad was, if I didn't have a good attitude, or if I just kind of was like not dialed or something, you know, he wouldn't necessarily be too happy about that. So I definitely dreaded the car rides back after like a bad practice or a bad match. I mean, for sure. I think everyone, you know, with dedicated parents that kind of really want their kids to succeed and kind of project that passion. It's, you know, it's not anything. I think that's a large reason, you know, the main reason as to why I became successful was how much energy and you know, commitment my dad and sacrifice that my family made. But, you know, specifically my dad, how much he put into, you know, developing me and my brothers and wanting me to be a success. And so, you know, as tough as it was at times, I mean, it was, I'm so grateful that, you know, that things were tough. I mean, I worked super hard and you know, we went through a lot together, but we have a bond, very long answer, sorry, but we have a bond now that obviously, is super special because our relationship is amazing. And, you know, he's a very smart guy, and he just, you know, we did the best of what we had, and I think he couldn't have done anything better, and I couldn't have asked for anything more.
Yeah, you look at the story of most pro tennis players, and there's always a parent that pushes. You know what I mean? Like, if this is my theory, right? Being a coach, right? Having an academy. If you leave it up to the kids, they'll sit at home, they'll sit at the crib and, like, watch TV, play video games, play with toys, that kind of thing. So it does take a mildly insane parent to be the driving force and to keep coaches honest, right? Because, you know, even totally. As a coach, right? Being a laid back parent that's not watching, you kind of like passing the time, milking the hour. But if you have a parent that like, no, I need some results out of this shit, then it's like, oh, now you bring your A game, right? So without that force, you don't make a pro tennis player, period, point blank.
Exactly. I mean, and it's hard for people that haven't gone through this process, like you and I, or just within in Tesla, to understand this, because it's like, oh, okay, well, the other sports you can start later, and this, or you know, kids, oh, I'll let my kid decide what he wants to do. Like, yeah, that's great. I mean, that's one way to do it, but I mean, and it might be, you know, there's no one path for everyone, and you hear that a lot. Like people, you know, but I will say that, you know, when you're a kid, I mean, you don't know what you really, you don't like, it's, you need some kind of direction. Like you said, I mean, if you're just like, okay, I'm going to do what I want, like, okay, I'll go play soccer for a bit, I'll go play hockey, I'll go play video games with my friends, and okay, I'll get my homework done. But really, like, the more time you spend at a young age on your craft, and it's even more so important in tennis, because you need to learn the technique and the skill and the hand-eye coordination, the ball control, and just general, you know, perception on the court and reading the game. And so the more time you spend there, and so again, because there's so many variables and so many different aspects of that sport, I think it's so critical to spend a lot of, you know, from a young age, more so than maybe some other sports, right? So, but like you said, I'm a very strong believer that, you know, if you don't have that one, at least that one person from a young age, that's kind of like, you know, keeping you on track or kind of pushing you in a good way, of course, then you know, it's not impossible, obviously, but I think the odds of succeeding are, you know, quite diminished at that point.
Yeah. So we look at your career, right? You've got to top four in the world in dubs, top 25 in singles. You've obviously played with some great doubles players, right? And had a lot of double success. All your partners are great. So I'm not trying to, you know, make you choose, right? But let's give me your top three doubles partners. I look at your list of partners. Whenever I mention doubles, I think of Brian Brothers, I think of Johnny Mack, I think of Jack Sock, right? So when I look at your department, yeah, obviously Jack stands out. Like, okay, that dude can play with anybody, right? And win. But give me your top three doubles partners.
I think Jack, Mahut, and Nestor were the three best that I've played with. I'm trying to think. I think Daniel Nestor, when he was at his prime, was even just very underrated. This might not sound great, but, you know, he didn't necessarily, in my view, have partners that, I mean, you know, I feel like he was, when he was playing well, I mean, this guy was serving big, returning unbelievable at the net. He was, I mean, I don't know who had better hands. For me, and it might sound biased because he's a countryman, but I've played against all these guys, right? I mean, I've played against, or at least of my era. Now, if we're talking about the Johnny Max, like, you know, now that's a whole other discussion. But if I just concentrate on what my experience is, for me, he was probably, I would say, the best. And then Jack, extremely explosive. Also, I mean, up there, just different qualities. I'll be honest, it's tough to separate those guys. They're all very different. They all have very different skills. And I think they can all win with a lot of different guys, you know, and they've, So those are three that I would say, that I've experienced playing with or against, are the three best. But, you know, there's a lot of singles guys that aren't focused on doubles. I mean, it'd be interesting, you know, I think if a guy like Federer was focused on doubles, I mean, he'd be the best ever, obviously. I mean, I can't, you know, so we can even forget about the three that I just spoke about, right? If you suddenly have these guys or Nadal or that, you know, start playing more doubles or start actually really wanting to do well in doubles, like it changes just that psychology, even just psychologically, how much that changes your performance on the doubles court if it's suddenly a priority versus like something you really, really want to do well versus just, okay, you're there to play and it's night and day, right? I think it'd be very interesting to see, you know, what some of these top singles players would be like if they focused on the doubles court.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've coached a couple top singles players, like, and our challenge with doubles is, you know, sometimes the scheduling just gets, you know what I'm saying? You know, it gets crazy, yeah. Right? Where you start making it deeper into the tournament, you got to start playing two matches in the same day, right? Or maybe you get lucky, yeah, and you play doubles on your off day, and maybe we could just not practice on the off day and use dubs as a practice. We, yeah, mentioned, like, I mean, how much better the game would be with Fed, Novak, Isner, even Isner playing more dubs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Playing more dubs, Tsitsipas playing more dubs. What do you think? And because you're very vocal on the tour from an organization and what we can do better standpoint, right? So what do you think we could do to get it where, and, you know, Fed is almost, you know, he's on his way out, right? And, you know, Novak will probably won't change his habits at this point. But what could we do to let the next wave of great singles players also play doubles? Like, how can we blend it better?
Oh man, that's a tough that's a tough one, because I mean the big issue there. I mean, okay, there's two issues, right? I mean, two major issues with that, I guess. Why top singles players don't play doubles, and the first and most obvious one is that, like you said, it takes energy, and you want to focus. I mean, if your priority is singles and you want to, you know, then just playing doubles and playing it consistently or putting a certain amount of mental energy into it, which, like I said, you kind of need if you want to play well. It's like that little switch, right? Like, you can spend time on the court and that might tire you out a little bit physically, but if you actually want to win, you need to have that mental switch, which most singles guys, you know, they don't want to even do because they're so concentrated on the singles. So just scheduling is the big one. I mean, it's also the reason why I haven't played really, you know, doubles the last 5 years. I mean, since I dropped a bit in the singles ranking, I was like, okay, I don't really want to play doubles until I'm back top 50 singles. And which is, you know, also ironic because then I'm in top 50 singles. So why would I want to spend energy doubles? But again, because, like, okay, you're playing qualities and there's a lot of, like, a lot of different things. Right. And so, I would say, yeah, that's just one. I don't know how that would be something that could get fixed, because people are always going to want to conserve their energy for the event that they're focused on. And then the second is, you know, the prize money, right? You know, if you suddenly have the same prize money in doubles that you do in singles, which, you know, I don't see happening anytime soon, but if that were to happen, I mean, you'd have more singles guys playing doubles because suddenly they're like, oh, if I win a doubles match, or, you know, versus my singles match, I'm making the same amount of money, or let's say 50%. Let's say if the person
half of that, right?
Right. So, I mean, that would change it for sure. But I mean, how would that ever happen? Like, you gotta doubles has to be as successful in singles, or make a like some kind of case study for that to even ever start being comparable, right? So, yeah, it's a tough one.
We'd have to grow the game, right? So you and I talk about
exactly, yeah.
We'd have to, how do we grow the pot in tennis, right? Right. The rising tide raises all boats, right? So,
yeah,
you know, if we grow the game, right, then coaches make more money, trainers make more money, players make more money, events make more money, you know, everything makes more, and then perhaps doubles could. So what do you think? Like, that's like a good segue into,
yeah,
what do you think we have to do to grow the game? Because it all, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a job. We're playing for money. Period, point blank, right? And,
yeah,
you know, you brought up the money in dubs. We need to bring up the money in tennis generally, right? What do you think we can do to grow, or we can compete with some of these, you know, NBA contracts now to get $30 million a year guaranteed, you know what I'm saying, contracts? How do we get there?
Yeah. Okay, so.
Because if you think about it, more people play dubs, like adults, like people who watch tennis.
Yeah, yeah,
more of them play doubles than singles.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. That's true. Okay, so if we just focus on, you know, growing the game, let's you know, if I separate doubles and singles now and just talk about tennis as a whole, obviously, you know, what each individual country does with the funds that they have that are, you know, meant to go towards growing the game at the grassroots level, or however it is, if it's Tennis Canada from the Masters, if it's the USTA, and if it's LTA, and you can, you know, that's okay, we could dive into what they can do, and, you know, there's no reason to do that. First of all, I don't even really know what they're doing differently, and I mean, I would have to be spend a couple months reading nonstop about what all these different countries are doing to help grow their sport locally and nationally. But if I look at it more from a macro, like, perspective in terms of, you know, in terms of something that I believe, obviously, you know, is what I think would be kind of like a catalyst or that could create a platform. And this might, you know, sound like I'm beating a dead horse here, but I honestly believe it's a player association, and hear me out. And why I think that's so critical is because as long as the players are not independent and they're basically in this kind of construct that is currently our one tour that we have, which is, you know, we have one tour, it's the ATP tour, and that's okay. But problem is what that does is it creates a monopoly, which is, you know, tennis is very, very much monopolized. And anytime you have a monopoly, that's wonderful for the, you know, the controlling party, because they're more or less doing what they want. The problem that creates is that you don't have an open market, right? You can't. So suddenly, in this case, you know, tennis is one of the most underperforming sports in the world. I think it's the third most watched globally. Unbelievable potential. And it's the worst performing of all the major sports. Like, and why is that? Well, now if we go back to this, you know, well, one of the things, there's a lot of reasons, okay? But one of my theories is that while it stays monopolized, basically the growth and the direction of the sport is completely contingent on the performance of one organization, right? So if that organization is, you know, doesn't hire the good people, is subpar, whatever, you know, it has an incredible product, so it still looks amazing because tennis is awesome. And we've had Federer, and we've had Nadal and Djokovic, we've had an unbelievable era. How is it not doing better than it's been doing? Well, maybe it's because of this structure, right? Why are still only the top 100 players able to make, you know, a good living? And so it's my belief that if we're actually able to become independent as players, which in and of itself, having a player voice or an association or organization that represents like solely the players, I mean, that needs to be there anyway. I mean, all the sports have it. That's like a basic, almost like a democratic like principle. You need to have, you know, some say, especially in a market where you bring so much value as a player group. So yeah, to go back, so now if you open the market, suddenly, you know, it puts pressure on these events. And if they're under, or these events, these tours, if they're underperforming, then something else can come up, and suddenly here's a plan. And not 100 players are going to make it, but 300 players are going to make a living. And now we have a system where, you know, 300 men, 300 women will be able to live off of this sport and not the way it is currently, right? And so I think it wouldn't be the goal of the player association to be that other option. It would be the goal to create this, you know, to become an independent, create the open market, and allow for competition to evolve naturally. And then, you know, and if it remains the way, it might remain the same tour the way it is now, but at least they'll be forced to step up and perform. One thing I would compare it to is, like, you know, airlines. I mean, Air Canada is the only airline in Canada. They have a monopoly, basically. And even in the US, you have American, you have Delta, you have United, South. Right. I mean, you have, and yeah. I mean, if I fly from LA to New York, if I'm flying around the US, It's like a quarter of the price as it is in the state in Canada. Like, I can't fly anywhere in Canada for less right now. I mean, the flight prices have gone up in general worldwide, but it's, you know, it's like four times the price probably, right? So, and why is that? Well, Air Canada have a monopoly, and they're the only ones that have the flights flying from Montreal to Vancouver and Vancouver to Winnipeg, or right. So it's a little bit of similar, a little bit of a parallel there, but you know, there's a long answer, but you know, I'm pretty passionate that I really do believe that will, apart from just servicing the players and making it one organization's top priority to make sure that players are taken care of and that they're, you know, trying to grow these services to as many players as possible. Apart from that, I mean, I just think it will just help the sport from at a higher level as well.
So let's talk about a tangent from that. Is you've seen like the big three, right? We keep mentioning Rafa, Nadal, Fed, and obviously they're in a tight race to be the greatest ever, the most Grand Slams ever. And I think that like this January, you know, decision not to let Novak play, and then the French being the next slam after that gives Rafa, right, obviously a two slam advantage. And then even potentially US Open, right? A three slam advantage, right? So, or another two slam that Novak played and won Wimby. Is that where you think sort of the competition would also come into, or maybe some more voices, right, to help manage those situations? Because we just saw that, you know, Montreal is not letting Novak play, which you got Rafa who's hurt, you Fed who's not playing, and you got no Novak now, right? That hurts. A, it hurts tennis. A, it hurts the players. And B, it hurts the individual event.
Yeah.
Right? What do you think about that whole, how that whole thing unfolded with the COVID entry and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think that, well, first of all, I think what happened, you know, in Australia and even now in New York, for example, and Novak not being able to play, that's, you know, I feel like that's, it's difficult to see a path as to how a player association can really affect a government guideline. So I mean, yeah, we could, for example, you know, you'd advocate for the player and whatever, right? And but ultimately there's very little you can do. It's, you know, will come down to how the governments decide they want to make the rules. And so I don't really, you know, I find it unrealistic to think that what happened in Australia wouldn't have happened if there was a player association. However, you know, there's player association would then be able to, you know, help in other ways, I'm sure, the individual players or whatever. But I will say that what happened in Wimbledon, for example, you know, them banning the Russian players and kind of the way that whole exchange occurred between the ATP and Wimbledon, and how, you know, they put these kind of the sanctions or, you know, then they remove the points as a way to say, okay, you guys, Wimbledon made a decision without consulting ATP. So now we're going to take away the points. And then everyone is waiting to go, is Wimbledon going to drop the prize money because of this? And so there was a situation where, you know, I'm not going to get into what was the right or wrong, you know, or what my opinion is on what should have happened, not at all, but basically what did happen that we can speak about, that I want to speak about is that you had this little battle between, you know, two organizations, or, you know, let's say Wimbledon and the ATP, and the collateral damage was the players, and they were making these decisions, and there's no real, like, they weren't really consulting with the players at all. Nobody knew, like, honestly, like, they didn't consult. I spoke to so many of the top guys, like, yeah, you had a player council, but player council, you know, it's, and how effective they are, that, you know, in the construct of the ATP is a whole other discussion. But so you basically had these two Goliaths kind of talking to each other, making these things. Players, you know, suddenly were the ones that were getting hurt. And there was no way to have this back and forth and discussion, which would be the case if we had a player association, for example. So there I would, like, you know, and maybe the outcome would have been the same. I don't know. But at least, you know, there would have been very good representation from all the parties, and some kind of agreement or some decisions can be made with everyone's input versus just, you know, the tournament and the ATP as an organization, right? So that represents, you know, that is, you know, largely a tournament organization at this point, unfortunately.
So we talk about Wimbledon and decision not to let Russian, better Russian players play. I want to take you back to 2015 because top 25 in the world, right? Quarters of Wimbledon in 2015. Quarters of any slam is hard, period, right? And I think in tennis, unfortunately, if you don't win a slam, they kind of forget. Like, I don't think anybody can name the other seven players who were in the quarters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in our sport, that is hard to do, to make second wave slam. So I want, but a lot has to go right. And I want to take you back to 2015 because, you know, when you think about all the things that can go wrong at a slam, right?
Or, yeah.
Right. And, like, you know, you've also had some injuries. What went right in 2015 that allowed that run to happen?
Yeah, well, a couple things for sure. One, I definitely got lucky. So in the very first round, In the first round, I was playing against Vincent Milot, a French lefty that I know quite well. He's a great guy. He's working for Tennis Canada now, actually. He's a Frenchman. And I was down 2-1, and he'll hate to hear this, but I was down 2-1 and 4-2, a break on grass. And I was kind of struggling a bit, like physically. It was pretty hot that day. I think I drank like 9 liters of water, which is whatever, how many, 2 gallons or something, but or a little more than that even. I was down 2-1 in a break, and I came back and I won the fourth in a breaker, and then I won the fifth, and then you know, went on a run, and I also, you know, third round I was meant to play Nadal, I think, in the third round. Was it third round or no, fourth round I was supposed to play Nadal, but he lost to Dustin Brown that year, so that opened up that little section, so it was better. I played Victor Troitsky in the fourth round, who is a great player on grass, and he made finals at Queens, I think, the week before. So he was in hot form and had good wins. But you know, it was better to play Victor than Nadal for sure in the fourth round, especially as you're getting later into the draw at Wimbledon, which I think he'll agree with. I don't think he'll be mad at me for saying that. But those were, you know, a few things that opened up there. And the other thing was the fact that I was actually healthy all the way through. Because I played some five setters. First round, I played a five setter against James Ward in the second round, I believe. Also I was down 2-1 there. But physically I held up really well, which is great, because I mean, that would kind of allow that run to happen, right? Because usually, the weather held up. It's like you said, you know, there are a lot of things have to align, and they did that week, right? So that was great. But kind of like if I compare it to, you know, when I played the US Open, for example, and I made the fourth round a couple of years ago, you know, by the time I was in the fourth round, my body was destroyed. I played again a couple five setters, but I had like a pulled muscle, and so then, you know, in the fourth round, it's like, okay, like, which always kind of impresses me that some of these guys are just, you know, I do my fitness, man. I work really hard. I got to tell you, my body type, I guess, just takes a little bit more impact when you're, you know, spending a lot of time on the court.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I always think about the things that could have gone. And really, you, like a lot of players say, you got to have a match where you got a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
I mean, I could think back coaching, right? You know what I mean? Where we, couple matches, 2017 US Open, I can remember a lucky moment, Sevastova match point, literally like had a forehand, she hit cross court, and I say floated the thing like a millimeter past the baseline, like done. Yeah. We were like going home, it was over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I can remember like 2018, first or second round of the French Open, as long as I got to the finals, Georgie, 2 match points, and yeah. Donald Dell stands up in the middle of one of the match points. Before like the point was over, like on the head sideline, we're sitting courtside. Donald Dell stands up like, yes, in the middle of Georgie's swing. And like totally interrupts the point. That was one match point save, right? And he's gonna take that, something like that. And look, I'm sitting there like,
wow,
he ain't with us. Don't call interference. Like, he's a fan, right? You know what I'm saying? So I can think about like the lucky moments, you know what I mean? If you win six matches at the slam, you got to have one where you like, damn, I stole
totally.
That
one. Totally. But I guess it evens out, right? Because that's the thing is tennis there's such like small margins, right? You just feel like there's so many matches that are won or lost on like these, you know, a couple shots, like you said, you hit a serve in by like a millimeter or this or whatever, right? And I guess that just happens so often throughout the year that there's also all these times where maybe, you know, things went against you and you don't remember that because nothing became of it, right? But like maybe that week, if that ball that you hit on that you were off break point in the third and you missed it by a millimeter, if that went in, maybe that was the run you would have made the final. So I feel like it's so that you always like focus on, because it always just becomes that much more kind of obvious, right? When you have these big runs and then anytime you do, like tennis is so, like you said, so exciting and so competitive and things can change on one or two points that it does feel like you have so many of these, like these moments where, you know, it kind of makes or breaks your event, but it's funny, like in aggregate, I feel like it probably evens out a bit too, but
you're right. So you mentioned Nicholas Mahut in this interview. You also talk about Wimbledon, right? And you think about like where you fall in the draw a lot. Obviously, you play Novak, Rafa, Fed, you're gonna be on center court, right? But you know, you also look at the schedule the night before and you're wondering, am I gonna be on court 2, 3, 14, 11, right? You know, depending on who you play. So which court do you prefer of those? And I thought about it when you said Mahut, court 3 or court 18?
Court 3 or court 18. Which one's court 3? Court 3 is a small center, is a small stadium.
Below the players' lounge.
Okay. Oh yeah, right. That's a great court. Or court 18 is the one Mahut
and Isner. Yeah. Court 3 or court 18.
I prefer court 18 because it's more intimate and I feel like it's a little bit more closed off. If I'm thinking of the same court, I like to play on bigger courts in general. Because I like when there's more people. I feel like I play better that I just, and players want to play in front of people. I think in general as an athlete, not everybody maybe, but I would be surprised if it wasn't the majority, but of those two courts, I would say the Isner Mahut court, just cause it has that like backdrop with those, the fan.
IB. With the IB.
Cool? Yeah. Yeah, it feels like a smaller court, so you feel like you can serve well, but there's also quite a few people, so it has a good atmosphere. I've played on that court before, and I would say it's probably one of my favorite courts at Wimbledon, actually. So I think they discontinued it, no? This year, or like last year.
Oh, it was used this year, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay, never 18? Mind. Yeah, I don't know what I'm talking about.
So let me ask you this then. So when the draw comes out, right, because – who's the one player, regardless of ranking, right? They could be having a bad year. They could just be coming back, whatever ranking is. One player that you like, please don't let me play this person.
Oh.
And not the big three. Not like.
Yeah, I won't say the big three.
Somebody in the middle. Be like, oh, this dude has my number.
You know what? I was just talking about this last night. I want to make sure this is the one that I wouldn't want to play. I just gotta think if there's another, but first name that comes to mind is Monfils. He's got my number. He's got my number. He wears me down, man. He wears me down. It's tough to blow through him. And he just keeps making me play extra ball. He wears me down. So I think I'm 0-4 against Guile. I don't want to play that guy anymore. I love him though. He's a good guy, but I still want to play against him.
he's one of those guys too, where it's like, you know, depending on how he's feeling, he could be 40 in the world. He could be 14 in the world. And you're like, come on, bro, please be seated. Please be seated. Yeah. Like, please like do what you're supposed to do so you could be seated. So like, cause I think the seeds hate that too. Like if I'm like a top 10 seed, I don't want to play Gale in the first or second round either. So I'm always like, bro, do what you're supposed to do. Be top 25. So that's why I see you to the third round. You know what I mean?
Totally. To my defense, every time I've played him, the four times I played, he's always in form at that time, I remember. So there's a little bit of, you know, it makes me feel a little better. But I did play him a couple of times where I was in form as well. But you know, maybe if I play him on a day where he's just, you know, like not feeling it and not doesn't want to be there, but you know, then maybe my chances will be better, but we've had a couple. He's a tough one for me, man. He's a tough one.
So you mentioned not want to be there. Tell me a stop on tour. It could be when you were first starting out, it could be 15 to 25, whatever. Tell me a stop on tour where you would never have to go back.
Oh, okay. Surprisingly, there was one very recently, because you'd think that maybe back in the futures days or, you know, there'd be a couple shady places that are gone, but there's actually one very recently, and I don't want to call them out because I don't want to be that guy, but, it was actually a challenger that I played. I was just like, I can never come back to this event. But I'm going to try to give you something a little, I'm going to try to give you something that was long, long ago so that I can actually bring up, so I can actually say what the name of the place and without hurting any like, feelings or something. But I played a tough one. Oh, okay. Well, it's just a memory, I guess. I don't know. I played one in, I can't remember if that one was El Salvador, if that was Guatemala. I think it was Guatemala. I can't remember now, but it was a futures event, I guess, 12 years ago, 13 years ago. I'm 32, so I'm getting kind of old for, but and there was a revolution or something going on during. So this is more about the events that were happening at the time, more so than the yeah. place itself. Although it wasn't luxury any either. So, but I was right. used to that. My dad and I. We went to all these all the crazy future tour events. And so, for me, that I can't even point one out that would have been worse than, maybe a handful of others, but this one's event, there was like a revolution going on or something. Like, I think the elections were cheated and there was like a big fraud. And so there was like an uprising and there were grenades, like literally they're like, there's going to be protests at 5 PM. Everyone has to leave. Latest at 3:30, so they literally like stopped the matches in the middle of the day, and we had to go back to the hotel. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is kind of shady. And then my dad and I took a bus because it was cheaper than flying. We took a bus from there through Honduras to El Salvador. I think it was like a $20 bus ride, and the bus was incredible. We had like these huge seats but that was very sketchy. Like, we should not have done that looking back, but we saved some money. That was good. We survived, but there was something that had happened like 2 weeks before with a group of tourists in the same, like in these buses. And I think, yeah, a story not worth repeating, but very dangerous. So that was just another fun experience. I have 30 of these stories.
Now, give me favorite stop on tour that's not a Grand Slam.
Favorite stop on tour that's not a Grand Slam. Indian Wells. Everyone's going to say that. Everyone's going to say that. Yeah. That's so and not easy. Only because of the event. I mean, the event is amazing, but just where you are, the location, like it feels so, yeah, calm. And also it's very close. And there's a lot of Canadians. There are a lot of Canadians there too. So I always feel like when I'm playing there, I'm like kind of half playing at home. So yeah, I would say Indian Wells, but if I could think of one that's a little less cliche or whatever, like everyone will say that, I would say another sneaky one. Can't think of it right now. I'll have to get back to you on that. I love coming here to Canada, obviously, playing at my home country, yeah. And the Vancouver Challenger was beautiful. In terms of like a lower level event, if I give a shout out to the Challenger Tour, I think the Vancouver Challenger has one of the best settings on the tour, just at a club like overlooking the city.
So I interviewed Mark Knowles a couple of weeks ago, and number one world doubles, number one world doubles, I think he only got as high as 69 in singles. What do you think? What's the gap there? So what do you think needed to happen in your career or still needs to happen in your career to try to get your singles ranking to equal what your doubles ranking once was? And it's always like, Knowles, he was very honest about mentally. He just was like a crazy man. You know what I mean? And just maybe just mentally, his mind wasn't as much of a weapon as it needed to be for him. So I'm just curious as to what you think.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what I think I need. So, okay, to answer that question, I think it's not, totally realistic to be able to think that my singles ranking can go as high as doubles if I'm focused on doubles or focused on singles, because the talent pool in the singles is higher just because you have all these greats that they also don't play doubles and they would be amazing in doubles as well. So I feel like, it's arguably a little bit less, it's less competitive, that's for sure. So that in itself makes it, Noel says, he didn't have the fire, but he didn't have to go up against Nadal and Federer and all these top 10 guys on the doubles court, and then being totally dialed and really wanting to win. So that's one thing. But
good point.
Yeah, the other thing, well, for me, I think what's been, you know, the last couple of years, and again, life is, I mean, you know, this is why tennis is so tough too, because you're out there on your own. It's an individual sport. There's nowhere to hide. If something's not going well, if you're a little bit less fit, if you're a little bit even, let's say, unhappier in your personal life, if let's say anything, right? If whatever it is, or if you're not training the right way, or if, like that's it, the margins are so small that there's 50 guys behind you that are just going to pass you in the rankings, right? So if everything's not going, like if 90% of your, of everything that you're doing in your life is not, you know, firing well, it's going to be very tough for you to be at your peak performance in terms of your abilities or potential. So for me, I think, you know, injury is one of them as well, obviously. So for me, I think a couple, you know, the last few years, apart from 2019 and 2020, when I came back from the back injury, I actually had a really good year, and I was top 30 in the race, but because of the double year COVID ranking system, I was like 60 or 65. So I know I still have that, you know, that ability in me, and it was not too long ago. But for me, it's really just about having, you know, like a stable team, coach, and the body holding up and being fit, because all these guys, you know, they're so incredibly fit, and it's sometimes it feels like that it's a, you know, a huge mountain to kind of try to climb, because I mean, I feel like, you know, do everything possible to be as fit as possible. And then the body even starts to break down because of how much work you're putting in. And it's not easy finding the balance. And I think that's a big one. And training the right way. And there's a lot. I mean, honestly, there's a lot. But long story short, I do think that I still have, you know, some great years in front of me. And I think that I'm improving and playing better than I ever have, I think, technically. And then I think physically, if I can hold up, without injuries and have a full year, you know, then I think I can get back up there in terms of, you know, close to what my career high was, at least.
Cool, man. Well, look, obviously you're a great player, favorite, always been a great dude. Wish you lots of success. I want to thank you for, you know, taking time to do this the day before, or 2 days before the tournament starts. In your home country there, Montreal. I'm mad I'm not there. I was going to go to Nilo's and get a meal. It's one of my favorite restaurants. Not to pick top five in the whole world. That's Nilo's would be on my top five. Yeah. But, man, I want to wish you lots of success.
Thanks a lot.
Keep working hard, man. Keep advocating for the players. Keep doing what you're doing, bro.
Thanks. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on the show. And, just got to keep going with what you're passionate about, right? Just kind of wherever life takes you. But I appreciate bringing me on your show.
All right, this has been the tennis.com podcast with Vasek Pospisil. Thanks for listening.